Thank you very much, Alistair. Colleagues and friends, as is noted, I am not Professor Mike Brooks, and unfortunately Mike is unavailable for this morning's session. He sends his apology and me. May I acknowledge the Kaurna people, the original custodians of the land of which the University of Adelaide's campuses here in the city at the Waite and Roseworthy are based. And in that context, I'd like to also take an opportunity to highlight the significant work and activities of our colleagues who, with the Aboriginal communities, are developing strategies and policies to lift the participation of our First Peoples in higher degree programs. It's something I know we are all very anxious to achieve. I'd like to start by thanking the organisers who have brought us to this conference today. The breadth and depth of the research being undertaken is truly building our stock of knowledge and our collective influence. The University of Adelaide is very pleased to be a sponsor. We are particularly grateful to assist in bringing colleagues from across the state, the country, and overseas to this fair city. At this point, it's tempting to outline all the wonderful things that are being done at the University of Adelaide in research and research training. May I take that as read? As has been highlighted by others, this is a very special conference in that it provides a forum for a wealth of experience, knowledge, and energy that are focused upon many fundamental questions. What is most refreshing for those who spend their days working on the operational matters is an opportunity to step back, even momentarily, and be reinvigorated by the ideas and experiences provided by colleagues and their presentations. It's a danger in welcoming anyone to a conference on higher degrees and research training to reflect on one's own experience and then tell war stories. Mindful of that concern, let me tell you a story. When I was commencing my own doctoral research, I was imbued with the spirit of exploration and innovation, and I did the natural thing. I looked for how everyone else had done it in the past. One scholar I admired for his style of writing and turn of phrase was the Australian historian Manning Clark, now out of favour, but at the time a public intellectual of note. Manning Clark died in 1991. He was a prolific scholar, publishing many works, including a 6-volume history of Australia. I had vaguely knew that he'd gone to Oxford in the 1930s to undertake a doctorate, but soon realised he'd never completed, and what emerged was an MPhil in 1944 from the University of Melbourne. The thesis was The Ideal of Alexis de Tocqueville. Reading the thesis, I was struck at how many of his stock phrases had become part of Clark's lexicon, had made their first appearance in this thesis. It was a work of clarity and obviously had a profound impact on his future research. Surprisingly, the thesis had never been published. Through a friend, I approached Manning Clark's widow, Dimphna Clark, about getting the thesis into some sort of shape for publication. What happened next was both exhilarating and a sobering moment. For a novice researcher like myself, Dimphna, a formidable scholar in her own right, agreed to publish it, and we had many enjoyable hours around the kitchen table of the Robin Boyd-designed house in Canberra with an Arthur Boyd portrait of Manning Clark watching over our progress. When it came to the introduction for the publication, Dimphna happily produced Manning's diary of 1940s, which recorded in agonising detail the inner thoughts of the young Manning as he struggled with his thesis. Now let me read you 3 entries. 20th September, 1942. Bad day with de Tocqueville. Only 1 page, and that includes 2 long quotations. I am aware of the gulf between the great ideas in my mind and the poverty of which I have to put them down. 26th of September, 1942. Failed with de Tocqueville. 9 lines, very poor quality, more determined than ever to be a writer, but still doubt my powers. I have wasted my life. 18th of October, 1942. Could not do anything with de Tocqueville, spent a day in idle fantasies, life is so meaningless. Now, please recall, I was a PhD student myself, and reading these chirpy accounts of what higher degrees and research was like gave me pause for thought. So the nub of the story is a reminder, at least to me, that while we rightly concern ourselves with systems, skills development, engagement, completion rates, technology, and all the policies that are driving researcher, in the end of the day, it's an individual struggling with an idea. I know that individuals and collectively, we contribute various ways to assist candidates to reach their potential and emerge not merely with credentials, but with an outlook and a resilience to add to the communities for which they come from and with which they live. I thank you for your deliberations. I hope you well. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, John. And I can relate to one or two of the quotes that you read out, as it was obvious other people could. I'd now like to welcome Dr. Hugh Cairns of Flinders University to the podium. Although those of you who've heard Hugh speak before will know he's very unlikely to stand very still behind it during his presentation. Hugh has had a long association with QPR and has, I think, been present at everyone that I've been to since 2008. Today he's kindly agreed to talk about an issue which is becoming more prominent on the doctoral education agenda, which is that of mental health. And we've had a number of presentations through the conference on these issues. Hugh lectures and researches at Flinders University here in Adelaide. He's widely recognised for his ability to apply psychological research to educational settings, and with Maria Gardner has co-authored 10 books which are in high demand both in Australia and internationally. As I noted yesterday, he's donated copies of these books to our poster presenters, for which thanks. Hugh is recognised internationally as a public speaker, and he regularly lectures at universities across the world, having recently returned from lecture tours of the UK, the US, and has included lectures at Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, Berkeley, and Stanford. And I do know that when we've been emailing each other to arrange this, each one has seemed to end up in a different city in Europe. So we ended up talking about my birthplace at one point. His areas of expertise include self-management, positive psychology, work-life balance, learning, and creativity. He draws on over 25 years of experience as a leading training and development professional within the corporate, financial education, and health sectors in Ireland, Scotland, North America, New Zealand, and Australia. Truly an international man. So if I could pass over now to Hugh Cairns on the topic of enabling mental health for research degree students. Thank you.
All right, well, good morning and welcome along. This morning I'm here to advocate for research students, in particular about their mental health. And I'm looking for your help in enabling mental health for research higher degree students. Now, when Alistair asked me to put in an abstract for this, I gave him several alternative titles, and that was one. But the others were supporting mental health, cheer up and chill out isn't enough. Does a PhD mean permanent head damage? Warning, a research degree can seriously damage your mental health. And I'm sure you've all heard the figures. You know, here in Australia, you'd hard not to know that about 1 in 5 people are likely to experience or are experiencing a serious mental health issue in any 1 year. And that is a lot of numbers. That means if we have 100 people here, about 20 people are currently or are likely to experience a mental health issue this year. That's a lot of people. And then when you look at the research, a study at Ghent University in May published last year that research students, some of the figures are even higher, and they found that about a third, or 32%, of research students reported symptoms that indicated a risk of common psychiatric disorders. and about half of them had at least two symptoms of poor mental health. So that's a lot of people. So how do we explain these high figures? Well, perhaps we recruit people that have higher levels of mental health issues. And there is some possibility about that, because a lot of research students are high achievers, tend to be slightly perfectionistic. And there is a sort of link between perfectionism and mental health issues. But I'm going to argue that, I suppose, is there something about the PhD or particular research degrees that increase the chances of mental health issues? Now, in my role, I travel all around the world, work with thousands of research students every year. And often they come up to me after workshops and they would tell me the strains and struggles of their experiences. And they sort of tell me things that they would never tell their supervisor or anybody in any position of authority within a university. And so today I'm going to speak for them, really. And I'm going to describe some of the themes and trends that I've seen emerge. Now, I could just list them out for you, but you wouldn't remember them. And you certainly wouldn't do anything about them. So I'm going to introduce you to two characters that will help you remember my message today, and hopefully you remember them for a long time. And these characters are going to be called Dick and Dean. So for the next few minutes, I'm going to get you to imagine that you're going to be working for Dick and Dean. I want you to imagine that you've just started a new job. All very excited about it. And let's say for the purposes of this story, your name is Phil. Okay, you start this new job, you're very excited, but a little bit anxious as well, because you're not sure how it's going to turn out. But it looks like it could be a really good job. So you turn up at the first day to meet your new boss, and he tells you that his name is Dick. And after a few days and weeks, you begin to discover out why he's called Dick. Because he actually is a dick. He's aggressive, he bullies you, he expects you to be in the office from 6 o'clock, 8 in the morning until 8 at night. He makes you do things that have nothing related to your job. He blames you for everything that goes wrong and humiliates you in front of other workers. So, that's Dick. So, after a while, how do you think your mental health is going now? If you had that for a little bit of a while, probably not very well. And by now you've got a nickname for Dick, and he's called Dirty Dick. But let's say you've had some good luck, and Dick leaves and he gets another job. In fact, he gets promoted. That often happens to Dirty Dicks. But you end up with a new boss. And oddly enough, his name is Dick as well. But he's not Dirty Dick. He's quite different. He's very clever, very smart. We're going to call him Clever Dick. But after a while, you work out that although he's very clever at this area of work, he doesn't know very much about managing people. He's never supervised anyone before. And because he's really clever, he's hardly ever around. He's never there. And when he is there, he's so busy he doesn't have time to meet you anyway. And when he does see your work, he just tears everything you've done to shreds and just says it's all rubbish. And he tells you what you're supposed to do, but he never tells you what to do, just leaves you to work it out for yourself. From talking to some other people, you work out that Clever Dick has never had any training in managing or dealing with people at all. In fact, he thinks that sort of stuff is just a waste of time. So, how's your mental health going now? It's probably taking another little dive down there. But then another surprise in store for you. When you started off doing this new role, you thought that you were joining some big organization. There's going to be lots of people around. But now you find out that you're on your own. Now, there are some other people around, but they have nothing to do with you at all. In fact, all the chatter and all the stuff going on just does your head in all the time. So you decide to work from home. It's quieter now, but now there's no one to talk to all day long. And you begin to start wondering about whether your work's any good and am I able to meet the standards? The standards seem so high. And of course, nobody's interested in your work anyway. Nobody ever asked you any questions about it. In fact, you could never turn up for days and they wouldn't even notice whether you were there. And worse, when you do ask Clever Dick if you can go to a workshop or a meeting, he tells you that's just a waste of time and just get on and do the job. So you're feeling isolated, things aren't working out, there's not enough resources, and it feels like there's no help around either. So how are you feeling now? Probably not very good at this stage. And this is where Dean comes in. Now you've heard about Dean, but you've never met her. She sent you some emails at the start telling you that she's there to help you and support you. But recently, the emails from Dean have been getting a bit mean. So maybe we should call her Mean Dean. She keeps sending out group emails about the importance of meeting milestones. The last one you got from her, she said, if people aren't making progress, they're going to be identified as at risk. Now, given that you have no idea how you're going and where you're supposed to be, are you getting a bit worried at this stage? So you decide to check with somebody in Dean's office, but you don't know who to contact. You get different stories from different people. The person you talked to last time is no longer there because there's been a restructure and so they've moved on. The new person directs you to the website. But when you go there, you can't understand half of the stuff that's on the website. When you talk to Clever Dick, he says, don't worry about all that nonsense. Just get on with the work. So, how's your mental health going now? Probably feeling a bit glum at this stage as it goes down. Eventually, it's all getting too much and you decide to make a meeting with Dean or with the sub-dean or the sub-sub-dean and you explain all your problems. Now, they listen sympathetically, but then they say, well, yeah, that's tough, but Fred, that's the way things are. There's nothing we can do. There are rules and regulations and we can't do anything about them. That's just the way things have always been. You just have to get on with it. So now there's no hope of changing or getting things getting any better. So let's call this person Routine Dean. This is just the way things are. So it seems that wherever you go, there are problems, things go wrong, you're hitting blockers all the way. It all seems a little bit hopeless. So how's your mental health going now, do you think? And finally, things have escalated. And now there's been a meeting about you. So Dirty Dick and Clever Dick and Mean Dean and Routine Dean, they all get together and discuss the problem. And after a little while, they begin to decide that the problem is you. They say to themselves, other people are going fine. I never had all this support when I started. We did all we could. All the information was on the web. We sent out the reminder emails. So, how's your mental health going now? You're probably feeling a bit bad at this stage and probably contemplating some extreme measures. Anybody in any workplace who would be experiencing that sort of stuff is going to feel pretty bad at the end of that. So, you've probably been joining the dots as this story has unfolded, and no doubt you can see that any student, with or without pre-existing mental health issues, would have major mental health issues by the end of all that. So what can we do about this? So, let's go back and have a look at Dirty Dick. Now, every university I've travelled with has its Dirty Dicks. You probably know who they are. You might never have met them, but you'll know them because you'll have heard the whispers, you'll have heard the undocumented complaints. You can recognise them by the trail of broken students that they leave behind them. I call these toxic supervisors. These are not bad supervisors. These are not poor supervisors. These are toxic. They shouldn't be allowed to supervise anybody. We and you and everyone in this room, we have a duty of care to protect unaware and naive PhD students from being exposed to these people. And of course it's hard because they're probably a big name, they got large grants and a great sense of entitlement about what they are. But somebody has to stand up and say enough is enough. And it is not reasonable to expect that somebody to be the student. So I wonder who in a university might that person be? And I think it's us. I think it's the people in this room. Deans of graduate schools, research developers, research administrators, all these people who deal with these people all the time. And I know this does happen in some places. Some universities set up supervisory panels and teams so that you're not reliant on one individual. It's not just down to one person. Some people approach heads of schools and heads of faculties and talk about these. And in some cases, you have to tackle the supervisor, the toxic supervisor, head on and say, this is not good enough. It's hard. But if we stand by and let it go on, then we let it continue. We become bystanders. And there was a report last year here in Australia into sexual assault and sexual harassment at Australian universities, the Respect Now Always. And they talked about the bystander response. And the vast majority of students who witnessed a sexual assault or sexual harassment did not report it or intervene. And the main reasons they gave were that they didn't think it was serious enough, or they didn't know what to do. So in terms of PhD students, we can't be bystanders and watch research students' mental health being eroded. It is serious enough. And if we don't know what to do, we need to find out what to do about it when we see it and put something into place. And what about Clever Dick, who's really clever, very competent in their area, but doesn't know anything about supervision? So supervisors need a lot more support. It's a tough job, and many are thrown in without any support at all. An academic can spend 10 or more years developing their academic expertise, but then we assume that a three-hour induction session is enough for them to be able to go out and supervise people. And now many universities do have registers of supervisors which require people to attend some induction of some sort, and that's great. Some require continuing professional development to maintain that supervision. Most require that you co-supervise it first before you're let loose on your own. These are good initiatives, but we need a lot more. And there were some good examples I heard here today, or the last called conference. Joe DeLuca over in Edith Cowan is doing a really good program, and Margaret Kiley is doing lots of really good work in this area, and UCD, Jenna Carton. There's lots of good examples of these things, but we need more of those. If we're going to increase the pressure on students to finish on time, then we need to provide a lot more support for supervisors. For example, realistic time allocations for the job. Clear expectations of what they're supposed to do. Workshops that cover more than just policies and procedures, but also how to deal with people and how to give feedback that doesn't crush students when you give it out the first time. And if you're telling me that you've given them the policies and procedures and signed them up to some online training, I don't think you're taking it seriously enough. And what about the isolation? Well, a PhD is an isolating experience, but some organisations, universities, do things to reduce the isolation. Supervisory panels, where you have several people to interact with, not just relying on one person. Cohort groups, where you go through with a group of other people and talk about the experiences. Contact people, who do contact the students, rather than waiting to be contacted. Meeting students in schools and faculties, rather than saying, it's all on the web. Workshops where they meet other students, postgraduate conferences, postgraduate retreats, there's lots of opportunities like that. The PhD needs to be more than a number in your little red book. They need to know, you need to know them. And so that's where we need a support team. The next one then is support team. The next one is mean dean. Now, first of all, I just want to clarify, I'm using the collective word dean here to refer to all deans, sub-deans, and all other deanlings. In fact, everybody in this room, so it's not just the deans. Now, when I run workshops for supervisors and I talk about giving feedback, I remind them of the difference between the thesis and the person. When the supervisor writes on a student's work, this is not good enough. What does the student read? I am not good enough. When you're sending out an email talking about progress points and milestones, remember that there is a person at the other end of that email. And it could be a person whose life is not going very well at that time. Remember that possibly one in three of those students might be experiencing some mental health issues at that time. When you say, our door is always open, remember, some students might not be up to coming through that door. Might not be that easy for them. So what we need are keen deans, someone that the students feel is on their side, supporting them to get through, celebrating their achievements rather than just pointing out when they don't achieve things. And then routine dean. Routine dean says, well, this is the way it always was. We've always been like this. But in my experience, it hasn't always been this way at all. Over the past 25 years, the number of commencing RHD students in Australia has increased sixfold. The number of international students has tripled in the past 10 years or so. So the number of research students has grown dramatically, much faster than the number of supervisors or the supports for them. In the past, the PhD cohort was more homogenous. Now it's much more diverse. We have much more part-time students, we have international students, students returning later in life, students with much less academic background, we have people who are working as well as studying. This diversity is great, but it puts much more demands on supervisors. And supervisors haven't got any more time. If anything, they've got less time. We now have thesis by publication. We encourage the students during the to publish during their PhD. And now the pressure is on to finish within 3 years or a certain time frame. But traditionally, PhDs took a lot longer. It was an apprenticeship model. Now it's sort of a mass education model. So things have changed, and the support needs to change too. And I see many examples around about this, you know, the rise of structured PhDs, cohort PhDs, professional doctorates, transferable skills programs. There's lots of examples where the support structures have changed. So it's not always was, always will be. Things have changed, and the support needs to change too. Students and supervisors need more support. And I wonder who should be pushing for that more support. And once again, I think it's us, the people in this room. We need to be out there arguing for more support for students and supervisors. In March this year, the HEFCE, or the Office of Students in the UK, awarded £1.5 million across 17 universities to improve support and mental health for students, for research students. So I think we need something like that as well. We need more things like that. So what we need is to see deans, keen deans and seen deans that are out there looking for stuff and encouraging the student to get to the end. And finally, blaming the victim. You know, you hear things like, it was just all excuses, they weren't organised enough, they weren't resilient enough. I never got support when I did mine, didn't do me any harm. If we run some mindfulness classes, maybe they'll be able to cope better. Maybe we should give them some stress balls with a counselling number on it. Now, if the rate of mental health was about 1 in 5, that's still a problem, but that's the general population. However, if it's higher than the general population, you begin to wonder, what's going on there? If 5 or 10% of students didn't complete their PhDs on time, that's not very good, but you know, you might think it might be the students. If 20, 30, 40% sometimes don't complete, you think maybe it's not just the students. If we set 3 years as our completion time and virtually nobody completes in 3 years, you begin to wonder, maybe it's not the student, maybe it's more than that. And so these figures suggest to me it's not the student, that we need to be looking at the system we're working in. We need to look at the way we do things. It's easy to set up milestones and send out emails when people don't meet them, but it's harder to review what we do. And again, I wonder who should be doing that. Who in the university might advocate for research students? Once again, I think it's us. Our role is not just to be reactive, to set up policy, follow policies and reminder emails, but to be proactive. And that means to argue to change the system. So we need keen deans who are there to encourage and help the student get to the end. So going back to the beginning, remember I introduced you to Dick and Dean? So my summary is what we need are less Dicks and a lot more keen deans who are on the student's team. As I said at the start, I'm here to advocate for PhD students and their mental health, but I need your help. You are the people who can do something about it. So I urge you to go back to your institutions and look at what you do. Does it enable mental health? Does it detract? How could you do something different? And then perhaps we can help Phil become Dr. Phil and maybe even still be smiling at the end. So thank you very much.